So this morning, I want to endeavor to finish up what we've been doing on covenant and dispensational theology, and we'll kind of move on there. Certainly, we've not exhausted it. If you've done any reading, and the internet, of course, is an absolute treasure trove of good literature on this stuff that you can find. You'll know that we have, in many ways, just scratched the surface. I've also tried to do a little bit of work to answer some of your questions about other denominations. And it gets a little more complicated because not some of the other denominations are not as, how would I put this? Because I'm really not trying to beat them up, but they're not as theologically driven along those things. They have their other versions of theology. If you're interested, and I can probably get you the link. I just actually stumbled upon this. Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary has a really helpful chart of dozens of denominations and where they would fit by church, church government, kind of by theological position, some of their highlights. And so that might be kind of a handy reference guide. With reference to the couple specifically, Methodists are not going to be reformed in their theology because Methodists are going to flat out reject Calvinism. True Methodist theology is blatantly Arminian, which means more than that you can lose your salvation. Losing one's salvation and the eternal security are kind of at the back end of the Calvinist-Arminian debate. At the front end of the Calvinist-Arminian debate is what role man plays in his salvation and to another extent the sequence in which that happens. Arminianism believes that men have it within themselves to respond to God when God meets with them, and that would be something that would drive a Calvinist to despair. So, so they would not be truly reformed. On the other hand, they do baptize babies, and to that extent, they're kind of a reflection of covenantal. Lutherans, quite honestly, Lutherans are, and I say this, really with some sympathy, and because my wife's family is Lutheran. And, I mean, when it comes to these kind of theological things, I just want to say the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod is just a flat-out hot mess. You can go to the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and if you type in Lutheran Synod Missouri, Lutheran Missouri Synod Lutheran Church Statement of Faith or Doctrinal Position, you can link over to their statement. And they, one of the things they will absolutely say is they absolutely call Calvinism heresy, and they reject it flat out. On the other hand, they are very akin to Roman Catholicism because they argue that the means of grace are external and that they are found in baptism and in the sacraments. And so, if you go to the Gordon Conwell, little schedule of denominations, and you get down to where are they in baptism? Are they pedobaptism, in other words, baptizing babies, or credobaptism, baptizing on a public profession of faith? Under Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary simply says both. So, they just really are kind of a hot mess trying to pin all that down. So the ELCA, the liberal wing of the radically liberal wing of the Missouri Synod, they're, anything goes. They're going to be clearly baptismal salvation. So I don't know if that covers all of the bases. The Presbyterians and the Reformed guys, because of this package to them of the covenant of works and the covenant of grace, they're gonna be much more inclined to try and tie all of this together into a synthetic system, and other people who are not thinking that way are not going to be, so they're a little more difficult to pin down. I want to just try and come back this morning, if I can move on to this, to try to address what I think is the main question of the dispensational covenantal theology issue. And I'm hoping that I'm consistent in the things that I say to you. In adult Sunday school, I'm talking through some covenant dispensational issues, so we're contrasting two systems. In the Bible class, in the academy, at the request of some of the students, we're kind of talking through some of the Calvinism issues. And again, you have two systems trying to elaborate biblical truth. And I'm not an enemy. I mean, there's a validity to putting oneself under the umbrella of a system. I don't deny that. But the system can't be the big thing. The big thing has to be touching on the biblical issues. So, all right, if I can just review this and make the contrast. Covenant theology is going to be characterized along three lines. Okay, it is going to have an ecclesiology. Ecclesiology is a view of the church. Okay, and within covenant theology, the New Testament church is Old Testament Israel, and Old Testament Israel is the New Testament church. They are one and the same, and everything that is true about the Old Testament church, I mean, the promises and the covenants are just going to be passed along to the New Testament. That's going to be their ecclesiology. Personally, I think to them, the preservation of their ecclesiology is the most important thing. Okay? They also have an eschatology, and eschatology is a reference to future events, the way things will work out, and they do not believe that there is a literal earthly kingdom in which Christ rules on earth. Again, if you go to the Missouri Synod Lutheran Church statement of faith, they blatantly reject any form of millennialism. I mean, they just go, we don't believe in millennialism, none of it. Classic covenant theology is going to be amillennial, although you'll find lots of post-millennial guys, and then they can fight that out on their own. Okay, and then covenant theology is going to be characterized by a hermeneutic. Okay. Hermeneutic is a reference, a way of interpreting. And passages about the future of national Israel are spiritualized. Now, that's going to be my assessment. That would be the dispensational position, that they spiritualize those passages. They would take exception to that and argue that we are advocating a too strict and a too literal interpretation. Not that they are spiritualizing, but they are approaching it normally. But they're spiritualizing it, arose by any other name, so to speak. Okay, dispensational theology is going to be characterized along the same three lines. We have an ecclesiology, a view of the church. To us, the New Testament church, what we are, is not the nation of Israel. And that the promises made to the nation of Israel do not get to automatically be conveyed over and appropriated to the New Testament church. And of course, to a covenant position, that would be a major disruption in the harmonious sovereign plan of God. We would not see it that way. They would. We are characterized by an eschatology, okay? Again, an understanding of future events. And we believe, and I've just got this up here this way, but I would make the argument this way, folks. More than anything, for me, for Pastor Ken Largent, I believe that the Bible is abundantly clear that there will be an earthly kingdom that will conclude the age. Revelation 20 reinforces the idea that it will last 1,000 years. But to me, millennialism has a lot more to do with the kingdom than it does the duration of that earthly kingdom. I mean, I would argue 1,000 years. Revelation 20 uses the word 6 times. But more importantly, you have a whole body of Old Testament, New Testament literature and all of these interactions about Jesus Christ and all of these New Testament promises that keep talking about kingdom, kingdom, kingdom. And many fundamentalists, I think to their great detriment, have treated all of those passages about the kingdom as if they are synonyms for heaven, some celestial body. And I just don't think that that's it at all. So that would be part of my eschatology. And then, of course, we're characterized by a hermeneutic, a method of interpretation. And we would insist upon a strict literal interpretation, particularly of the eschatological passages, particularly of future events. And that's where I want to go this morning. And I would argue that to us, those of us who would broadly identify ourselves as dispensationalists, that for us the main thing is the hermeneutic. That for us the main thing is endeavoring to consistently, literally interpret every passage of Scripture. And again, I'm not talking about, you know, doing something goofy with clear figures of speech or, you know, the parables, but the Bible themes that are developed, letting them develop literally, and then whatever that looks like. And again, my criticism would be that covenant theology is driven by an adherence to an ecclesiology. The church is Israel. Now, how do we preserve that model? So we're obviously going to approach this somewhat differently. Okay, let's look at the passages. All right, because here's where going to be some of the questions lie. Okay, and again, I would argue the primary question before us is not would we be dispensational or covenantal, but the real question is, are passages like the ones we're going to read predicting a literal truth or a spiritualized truth? In other words, are they just, and I want to be careful here because I'm really not trying to bash them, but are these kind of romanticized, I mean, they're inspired, but they're romanticized, sentimentalized ideals of the way that it's just going to shape? So, I mean, to spiritualize it, could we say, since it's inspired and it's of God, it is absolutely positively good, and then we don't really know a lot about how the good's going to look? Or, when God says certain things, do we go, that's the way it's going to be? And of course, with our literal view, this is what it's... what is at stake? And I'm stealing this from Dr. Mark Minnick, who's... God, an incredible mind and an insight, and happens to be strongly dispensationalist here. What is at stake is God's glory. That would be his position. The question that I asked when I thought about that is this. Has the God who did not abandon national Israel because of their idolatry, and that's really what's going on, folks, in the whole making of the golden calf thing. Right? The whole issue in the making of the golden calf is, what is God going to do with the people who are immediately unfaithful to the covenant? Is the God who would not turn his back on them because of that, now turning his back on them because they've rejected Jesus? And that's where you have to be covenant, that the whole thing has come unraveled, and that the proclamation, house is left unto you desolate, Matthew 23, is the end of Israel having any bearing at all on the unfolding Bible picture. They still exist as a nation, but they have no real significance. They have no more significance than any other nation you could find on planet Earth. God is done with them, finished, it's over. The promises have been transferred to us. They have been abandoned. God finally made good on what he has been threatening to do. That's the position. Okay? And Dr. Minnick argues, and I think he's arguing correctly, that the covenant position really strips God of some glory by having God, in essence, throw up his hands in abandonment and go, you guys, it's not even worth messing with you anymore. I'm going elsewhere. That's an interesting question. Do they allow that God would someday abandon the church? I've never heard them say that, no. I've never, and all the stuff that I've read on this, I've never heard of anybody even suggest it. Right? That what has been given to the church is, right, we go to the end and... and well, that's a great question. Why should we believe that God wouldn't abandon us if he abandoned the church? But they certainly believe in the perseverance of the saints that God will not forsake those people. So again, I mean, I just think, you know, I just think that the covenant position is really, 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 really weak. Really weak. Even though it is tremendously popular. And it is grown in popularity in recent days, in the last 20 or 25 years. I mean, folks, all of these, you know, and I don't know how much you get into this, and I'm not trying to insult you. I mean, I just don't know how much you pay attention to this. But, you know, in the world of Christianity, we certainly know that the world of Christianity is moving down a road where we have more praise and worship kind of music, you know, where there's a little more contemporary element to what's going on. And there are some massively powerful men and assemblies who are part of this. This is not a fringe movement. But many of those guys, not all of them, but many of those guys are incredibly reformed. Okay? I mean, you know, one of the guys who writes a ton of books that lots of people read, and I have him in my library, is Kevin DeYoung. He pastors a Presbyterian church outside of Charlotte, North Carolina. They have 750 families in their membership. And, you know, you don't join a Presbyterian church easily. You don't just walk in the door and go, hey, I want to become a part. It doesn't work like that. I mean, they got 3,000 or 4,000 people that attend this thing. They have a 69, I think if I remember correctly, they have a 69-acre campus where the church meets. I mean, you know, and there are guys like that, and they are in this reformed, this Calvinistic, Presbyterian form of church government, you know, amillennial or perhaps postmillennial, and they are, and these are the guys that even guys in our camp look to a lot for, you know, philosophical direction and you know, the mechanics of ministry. These guys are, you know, these guys are really big guns. There has been a resurgence of this. There has been a resurgence, right? And actually, I'm going to talk about this next week. And so just so you can brace yourself, okay? Next week's Sunday school class will be about 99% history. And because 2017 is the 500th year anniversary of the Protestant Reformation, and we should pay a little homage to that, and so we're going to take a whirlwind trip through church history next week. But you know, we call this Reformed theology because it goes back to that period of time and what guys like Calvin, you know, and others were arguing and articulating. And setting forth. All right, I got to quit meandering here. All right, Isaiah chapter 2. Let's look at some of these passages. Almost everything that we're going to look at this morning is in Isaiah, and I'm going to try and get through this, even if we don't read all of the passages in their entirety. All right, Isaiah chapter 2. All right, verses 1 through 4. The word that Isaiah the son of Amoz saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. All right, so according to the passage, what is the subject matter? Judah and Jerusalem. Unless it's not Judah and Jerusalem. Unless Judah and Jerusalem are euphemisms for the church. And if we were going to be covenant in our theology, that's where we would have to come down. Verse number 2, it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains and shall be exalted above all the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall go out and say, come ye, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. And he shall judge among the nations and shall rebuke many people. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. O house of Jacob, come ye and let us walk in the light of the Lord. Now, there's a lot more to the passage, but verses 1 through 4 explain this is what happens in the last days. In Isaiah 22, 5 through 10, God begins to talk about his punishment upon Israel for their idolatry. And the question becomes, is that punishment a temporary punishment or is it a permanent punishment? And then in verses 11 through 22, and again, I'm looking at the clock and I'm looking at how many verses I got to get done through. Okay, in verse number 11, then, you have down through the end of the chapter, you have an explanation of, again, a returning of what the end times are going to look at, what the last days will be. Turn to Isaiah chapter 11. And here I do want to take time to read a little bit more. Isaiah chapter 11, and in verses 1 through 3, you have a description of what the Messiah will be like. There shall come forth a rod out of the stem of Jesse, a branch shall grow out of his roots. And by the way, this is a shoot. Okay, we're talking about like when a tree sends off a small branch. Okay? A netzer. A netzer is the word. A Nazarite. Or a this is the idea here. Coming from, right? The little, apparently insignificant sucker grows into this massive tree. A branch shall grow out of his roots, and the Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him. The spirit of wisdom and understanding, the spirit of counsel and might, the spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Lord. So that's what he will be like. In verses 4 through 9, you have an explanation of what the kingdom will be like. But with righteousness shall he judge the poor and reprove with equity for the meek of the earth. And he shall smite the earth with the rod of his mouth, and with the breath of his lips shall he slay the wicked. And righteousness shall be the girdle of his loins, and faithfulness the girdle of his reins. The wolf also shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the kid, and the calf and the young lion and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them. And the cow and the bear shall feed, their young ones shall lie down together, and the lion shall eat straw like the ox. And the sucking child shall play on the hole of the asp, and the weaned child shall put his hand on the cockatrice den. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth shall be full of the knowledge of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. That's what the kingdom will be like. Now again, right, is this a highly romanticized, idealized account? In other words, is it primarily poetical of describing this glorious, tranquil, peaceful world? Or will lions really eat grass? And will children really play with snakes? Not just snakes, poisonous snakes. Or what had once been poisonous snakes. Verses 10 through 16 then describe what the king will do. Jesus is the king, 11, 1 through 3. The kingdom will be like, verses 4 through 9. And what the king will do, verse 10. And in that day, there shall be a root of Jesse, which shall stand for an ensign, a flag of the people. To it shall the Gentiles seek, and his rest shall be glorious. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria and from Egypt and from Pathros and from Cush and from Elam and from Shinar and from Hamath and from the islands of the sea. And he shall set up an ensign for the nations, and shall assemble the outcasts of Israel, and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. The envy also of Ephraim shall depart, and the adversaries of Judah shall be cut off. Ephraim shall not envy Judah, and Judah shall not vex Ephraim. But they, remember, this is now reference, of course, to the Civil War, right? That goes back under the days of Solomon, to the divided kingdom. But they shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west. They shall spoil them of these together. They shall lay their hand upon Edom and Moab, and the children of Ammon shall obey them. And the Lord shall utterly destroy the tongue of the Egyptians, say, and with his mighty wind shall he shake his hand over the river, and shall smite it in the seven streams, and make men go over dry shod. And there shall be an highway for the remnant of his people, which shall be left from Assyria, like as it was to Israel in the day that he came up out of the land of Egypt. So there's the characteristic of what the king will be like in the day when what the king will do in the day when the kingdom exists, when the Messiah comes. Again, figurative or literal. And covenant would go, well, Israel's going to lose that and the church is going to inherit that. Now, they can point out problems. When you interpret the Bible literally, there are problems, and I would not say for a moment that we fix all of them. But I would ask this question. If these are only figurative, poetical words, what does the word second time mean? Why would God put it that way? If he doesn't really intend to do it to Israel a second time. If he only meant to do it once and then do it for us. So it's not just that we are being overly literal. It's that in our estimation, we're rejecting a horrific butchering of the text of Scripture. 11:11, it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people. What's the first time? What's going to be the first time that God destroys his people? The exile. And then what does he do at the end of the exile? He brings them back to the land. Right? Nehemiah, Esther, the end of the Old Testament. Come back to the land. We're going to build the temple. Here we are again. There is the punishment. There is the recovery. Is it going to happen again? Isaiah says it is. And again, the question is that just a spiritualized explanation or is it a literal explanation? And what would that mean about God and his glory? All right, I'm just going to put this one up here on the assumption. Well, go to Isaiah 61. I'm going to read the New Testament portion, if that's okay with you. Not the New Testament account, but the portion of it that we find in the New Testament. Isaiah 61:1, the Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord hath anointed me to preach good tidings unto the meek. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to them that are bound, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. That's the passage that Jesus preached in his first public sermon in Luke chapter 4. And Luke is very careful to tell you that when Jesus got to that portion of the scroll, he closed the book and he read no more. There's a lot more to read. But Jesus did not read the section that says, and the day of vengeance of our God, and to comfort all that mourn. That's not there. There's no vengeance. There's no retribution. Go down to Isaiah 61:7. For your shame shall ye shall have double, and for confusion they shall rejoice in their portion. Therefore in their land they shall possess the double, everlasting joy shall be unto them. So again, the question is, when Isaiah preached those words under the inspiration of the Spirit, did he really mean in their land? Or is that just figurative language for the glory of the church? And we would argue these are literal words that Israel will be in their land. Isaiah 65 and verse number 17. For behold, I create new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered nor come into the mind. Now, you can find that fleshed out a little bit in Revelation 21 and 22. Because that's where the Bible ends, with a new heaven and a new earth. If you go to verse number 18 of Isaiah 65, it's like you step, it's moving forward in Isaiah, but it's moving backward in Revelation. And verses 18 through 25 can easily be compared with Revelation 19 and 20. But be ye glad and rejoice forever in that which I create, for behold, I create Jerusalem a rejoicing and her people a joy. And I will rejoice in Jerusalem and joy in my people, and the voice of weeping shall be no more heard in her, nor the voice of crying. There shall be no more thence an infant of days, nor an old man that hath not filled his days. For the child shall die 100 years old, but the sinner being 100 years old shall be accursed. And they shall build houses and inhabit them, and they shall plant vineyards and eat the fruit of them. They shall not build and another inhabit. They shall not plant and another eat. For as the days of a tree are the days of my people, and mine elect shall long enjoy the work of their hands. They shall not labor in vain, nor bring forth for trouble, for they are the seed of the blessed of the Lord, and their offspring with them. And it shall come to pass that before they call, I will answer, and while they are yet speaking, I will hear. The wolf and the lamb shall feed together, and the lion shall eat straw like the bullock, and dust shall be the serpent's meat. They shall not hurt nor destroy in all my holy mountain, saith the Lord. So again, folks, our options are to interpret this spiritually and have Jerusalem represent Westwood Heights Baptist Church and other churches, or to interpret them literally and see the kingdom. Right? And all of this language, folks, if you go back into the book of Deuteronomy, you find those cursings and threatenings there. Right? God says, if you don't follow me, and if you don't love me, and if you obey me, you'll plant, somebody else will get it. You'll build a house and somebody else will live in there. I'm going to take all that stuff away from you. So when God says these things, he is promising to recover what he had threatened to do and what he once did in the captivity. Okay? Let me just kind of walk through this, okay? Because I want to come now and bring some New Testament into it before we do that. Okay? What is the point of the nation of Israel? Well, the point of the nation of Israel in Isaiah 46:13 is God's glory. I bring near my righteousness. It shall not be far off. My salvation shall not tarry. And I will place salvation in Zion for Israel, my glory. Right? And the whole theme of the book of Isaiah, folks, is that God is going to recover the day when Israel trusts in him alone. This is his plea to them. Trust in the Holy One of Israel alone. Isaiah chapter 10. If we go back there for just a moment. And it shall come to pass in that day that the remnant of Israel and such as are escaped of the house of Jacob shall no more again stay upon him that smote them, but shall stay upon the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. That's where they'll lean. The remnant shall return, even the remnant of Jacob, unto the mighty God. For though thy people Israel be as the sand of the sea, yet a remnant of them shall return. The consumption decreed shall overflow with righteousness. Now here's part of the question, folks. Okay? If God is finished with Israel, if their rejection of Jesus and their crucifixion of him was the end of it, why does God keep talking about a remnant that returns? What is that remnant? If you and I can legitimately come to our Old Testament and take those promises that are made to Israel and go, but they now belong to us, where does the remnant fit? What is its point? And yet, the remnant is a critical part of New Testament theology. Turn, if you would, to Romans chapter 11. So Romans is the great book on salvation, right? And the first five chapters emphasize that salvation has always been, always will be, by grace through faith in God's promised Messiah, never through human works, that in the Old Testament, that's the way that it was, and it carries over into the New Testament, and that while the law is a valuable tool, the law just simply points out a man's condemnation. A man is already condemned if he doesn't have the law. That's all being developed, Romans 1 through 5. In Romans chapter 6, Paul begins now to talk about living out the life of somebody who has been saved by faith through grace. And it is not simple, easy, painless. It is a perpetual struggle. And so Romans 6 says, do not yield your members as instruments of sin. Fight the fight. Romans chapter 6, if I was going to alliterate it, and I would alliterate it this way, Romans chapter 6 is, Christians have a duty to fight the fight of faith. Romans chapter 7, it is a difficult fight. Romans 7, I find a law that when I would do good, evil is present with me. Right, so we frequently find ourselves as Christians tottering on the brink of despair. Am I really saved? How could somebody who is really saved do what I do? How could I think these things? How could I say these things? How could I desire these things? Am I making any progress? Does all these years of going to church and reading my Bible, has it accomplished anything? I feel like I'm just hanging on by a thread. Romans chapter 8. The decree. This is the great chapter in which God takes you from the dark, dark past, foreknowledge, to the bright, bright future, glorification. And God's position is, look, I ordained the fight, but you're not secure because you're fighting a good fight. You're secure because I made decisions before the world was ever formed about you. Anybody who can think through that statement is going to find gargantuan problems with it in light of their humanity. And so Romans 9, 10, and 11 become God's defense of his choices. And of course, this is part of where the great Calvinism, Arminianism fight rages, and where we fight about free will and what it means and what it looks like and election and all of those things. And all of that framework, folks, takes place within the nation of Israel. Okay? To go back to the question that was raised at the very beginning of the class, does a covenant theologian ever argue this? God once abandoned Israel because of their rejection of the promises, and God will abandon the church because of their rejection of the promises. Paul has already beat them to the punch, because Romans chapter 9 begins with probing this question. If God made all of these promises to Israel and gave them the covenants and the law and people like Abraham and people like David, and all of Israel turned around and hurrayed when they crucified Christ, can God really do anything? Not as though the word of God had taken none effect. Well, what about Israel? And that's where we are, and I've got to move quickly now. Romans chapter 11. Romans chapter 11 answers two questions. Both of them are about the nation of Israel. Romans chapter 11 and verse number 1. I say then, hath God cast away his people? Here's a question. Has God repudiated him? That's what the word cast away means. Has God said, I'm done with you. I take everything away from you. I know I made those promises, but you reneged on them, and we are finished. You are gone. You are done. Into the dustbin of history with you, Israel. And what is the answer to the question? God forbid. I also am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. God hath not cast away his people, which he foreknew. Now, that may make a lot of people angry, and it may make a lot of people confused, but that is what the text of Scripture says. We look and go, it doesn't look like God is doing anything. We're preaching the gospel and nobody's getting saved, and we're working hard and nobody's living righteously. God, what do you have to say about that? What I have to say about this is, the ones that I have picked are going to be just fine. That's what I have to say about it. Second question. is God's hardness against Israel permanent? Because he has dealt with them severely. And that's verse 11. I say then, have they stumbled that they should fall? Have they stumbled that they should fall? Notice again in verse number 11 the answer. God forbid. Right, this is one of the problems, folks, okay? And if you... This is one of the reasons I get real touchy when we get into start talking about the systems, because I would broadly identify myself in a couple of ways with the systems, but I want to give myself lots of wiggle room. Right? Because, look, when you read the Bible, it will lead you to conclusions that appear to be blatantly clear logically. And God periodically has to draw us up short and go, "You, but you can't go there." Right? And so the farther you go into the system, folks, the more of those kinds of issues you find, particularly with Calvinism and Arminianism, where you find yourself filling in large gaps of lack of information with things that sound logical. And the danger is that every time in Romans 9, 10, and 11, you come to a logical conclusion, God basically smacks us in the face and goes, "But you can't have that position." So, did God repudiate his people? No, but he sure dealt with them harshly. Well, is this hardness against them permanent? Nope. God has not repudiated his people. What's the answer? The answer is remnant. Verse number 4, for instance, okay, because I'm really running out of time here. But what saith the answer of God unto him? I have reserved to myself 7,000 men. Verse 5, even so then at this present time also there is a remnant according to the election of grace. I'm just looking quickly to see if there's more remnant there. What is God's answer? God's answer is there's a remnant. The harshness is not permanent. They didn't stumble so that they could fall. They did stumble. Why did they stumble? Romans 11, 25. For I would not, brethren, you should be ignorant of this mystery, lest you should be wise in your own conceit, that blindness in part hath happened to Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles be come in. Now, and actually we're going to touch on this indirectly. I didn't deliberately work this out, but we're going to touch on this in the morning's message. Frequently, folks, we look around at the world and we come to the conclusion that God has either gone on vacation and left us to our own devices, God is a big bully who is enjoying our pain, or God is a bumbling, incompetent deity who hasn't got a clue what's going on. And the reality is none of those can be supported from Scripture. That God always is thoroughly and firmly in control of what's going on, and he's working it to its own purposes. So why are the Jews crucifying Christ? So that he can save more Gentiles. And that's the choice that he made. And if we go, well, you know, it just irritates the fire out of me that God would make those kind of arguments, then I just take you back to Romans chapter 9 and let the text spank you around a little bit. And so ultimately, Romans 11, 26 and 27, what is the conclusion? Israel will be saved. Now again, our position would be, folks, that this is what is being described in the book of Zechariah. On the great day that we will go into the tribulation, there will be this great war against the nation of Israel, that Israel will be on the absolute brink of being destroyed and overcome, and at that exact moment, Christ will return and Israel will get saved. And then Paul concludes with, I told the kids in class, and this would be to put it, you know, are you a Calvinist? I'm a Romans 11:33 Calvinist. These things are past finding out. They cannot be explained. But this would be our literal interpretation, and I realize I get a little bit off track here, but this would be where we would conclude from a literal interpretation, that God is not done with Israel, that we don't get to take all of those promises that were made to Israel, that God is going to recover the nation, he's going to put them back in their own land. He's going to do this. This is going to be the characteristic of the kingdom. We think it's going to be 1,000 years. David is going to be resurrected. He's going to be the king of Israel. That's going to be his territory to rule. Jesus is going to have, for lack of a better word, headquarters in Jerusalem, and he's going to rule the world from there as the king of all of the earth, and all of the nations are going to exist, and everybody is going to have to contend with Jesus and Israel. Just like, folks, if I can be so bold, just like virtually every other nation in the world has to contend with the United States at some level. We can't just be ignored. Well, not everybody likes us, but nobody can ignore us. That's going to be some of the characteristics of the kingdom. That's another subject. Okay, it is now 10 to 11. Questions, comments, quickly.